Chuck Collins gave up his inheritance when he was 26 years old. Did it turn out okay for you, Chuck?
So far, so good. Thanks, Tim, for having me.
Well, it's good to talk with you. We've talked a few times through the years, and this decision you made when you were a young man, what was the catalyst?
You know, I had a job working with some low-income folks who were tenants in mobile home parks who were trying to buy their parks. And I just had this experience of seeing how hard they worked, how much they helped each other. And I kind of wanted to live in the same kind of world they lived in a sense that they really were stood up for each other. And I was at a point where I just realized I think that the inheritance that I had was a barrier to my making my own way in the world. So it was sort of a simple, selfish decision in the sense at that time. But it in a way, it allowed me to look at the inequalities that have opened up in the last 30 years pretty unflinchingly, if you will.
One of the aspects of the Affordable Care Act is that some people believe that those who are working hard are paying for the health care for those who are not. Is that simplistic, or is there some truth to that?
Well, I think we're better off when we have a health care system where we spread the risk around, and that means healthier people do end up paying premiums that they don't use for their own health. And yet, what a good healthcare system does is I think it does, it's there when everyone needs it. And I've been watching this debate thinking, golly, you know, I grew up in Michigan, in northern Michigan, where, you know, 1 out of 10 households depends on the Affordable Care Act. And I worry, you know, if we change that priority. So I think we want to live in a society where no one goes without health care. And that may mean that some of us who are healthier or more affluent or younger pay into a system, just in the same way we want to have a Social Security system that works when we all retire.
As far as the plan that the Republican majority in Congress has been floating, is that something you can live with?
No, I think it takes us in the wrong direction. I mean, I think there's obviously things about the Affordable Care Act that would be great to strengthen. It would be great to strengthen the markets in different states. But to push 20 million plus people off of health insurance, to go back to a system where people bought these very flimsy, catastrophic health insurance policies and ended up still paying tens of thousands out of pocket when something bad happened, I don't think we want to go back to that. I think we want to go forward to a system that continues to cover more people and also brings costs down, provides incentives for getting the cost down.
Well, the situation you're speaking of, the overall theme of wealth inequality has gotten to a larger degree worse, if you view it that way, in the last 30 years, as you stated, between 1979 and 2007. The 1% at the top had their income doubled, whereas low and middle income households actually declined. So with that as the backdrop, with 1% of the people having more wealth than the bottom, the bottom 90%. The top 1% has more wealth than the bottom 90% in the United States. Is that something that is good for our country?
Well, and even since 2007, 2008, it's become more dramatically unequal. So we're, you know, the most of the income and wealth gains since the economic meltdown in 2008 have gone not just to the top 1%, but the top 0.1%. So folks with wealth over $40 million are capturing most of the income and wealth gains. I think it's perilous for the country. I think, unfortunately, it destabilizes the economy. It creates volatility, more booms and busts. When working people don't have enough money to save and consume in the economy, that puts a drag on the economy. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why we should be alarmed about it. And even small business people I talk to are just concerned about, you know, can their customers afford to pay for the goods and services that they buy as wealth more and more concentrates at the top. So there's I think it's an alarming situation.
There are those who say this is simply a byproduct of a capitalistic society, that there are always going to be haves and have-nots, that winners and losers. Is that something that is inevitable?
It doesn't have to be inevitable. I mean, if you think about the 30 years after World War II, 1945 to 1975, we were a vibrant capitalist society, but we had considerably less inequality. In fact, I think it was a healthier society in many respects. And a lot of business people I talk to look back on that period and say, yeah, we're now living in a period of kind of hyper-extreme extractive capitalism, you know, where, you know, every company is nickel and diming us, you know, the cell phone companies and the cable companies. Everybody's taking more money out of our pockets and squeezing working people harder and harder. And it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, I think that, you know, we taxed ourselves at much more progressive rates under President Eisenhower, and we invested in debt-free education and first-time homebuyer programs and things that help launch a middle class and first-class infrastructure in this country. So we sort of have lived through a period of much greater equality, and it didn't undermine the health of our capitalist system.
And when you mention the number of what the highest tax rate was under Eisenhower, people say that can't be, can't be. What was it?
Well, I think it was if your income was over $400,000, which is roughly about the equivalent of $2 million today, any dollar over that was taxed at a very high rate. I think at 91%.
91%. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that wasn't the rate all the way through. So, but let's say you were a wealthy person in the top 1% under President Eisenhower. You probably paid closer to half of your income in income tax. There were more loopholes. But it was about twice as much as what the wealthy pay today as a percentage of their income. Same with inheritance taxes. We taxed inheritances at a higher level, you know, among the very wealthy. I mean, the equivalent today of people with over $10 million wealth. And, you know, it wasn't that that money just went nowhere. It actually went to build this, build the public investments that help expand the middle class, which, you know, I think everyone would look back on and say that was a good investment. The GI Bill and the interstate highway system and some of these investments that expanded opportunity that's benefiting, you know, families even today, the next generation.
877-217-5757 is your number for Chuck Collins, one of the foremost philanthropists in the world. He gave away his inheritance, which was sizable, it was more than 30 years ago. He was 26 years old. I think it was 1984. But at any rate, at age 7, 50 years ago, you witnessed the Detroit riots, exactly 50 years ago. And that had a huge impression on you. What happened at that time to you?
Yeah, you know, the anniversary was yesterday, and I've been thinking about that. I was 7 years old, and I remember just seeing the news coverage and trying to understand what was happening. But and thanks to my mother, who grew up on a farm in Ohio, her perspective was, you know, this has to do with how unfair the system is for many people, and I understood that to be the gap between inner city Detroit and the wealthy suburb I lived in, white and black, rich and poor. You know, Detroit was a very, very tough city to be. You had, you know, an all-white police force raiding a black after-hours club, and that was just lit the fuse. And but it made me understand that inequality creates instability, and it undermines that sense that we're in this together. And if some people feel like they have no hope or possibility, that it leads to, you know, volatility and riots. And you know, that's not where we want to go. And if we just don't do anything about the levels of inequality that we're living with today, we're going to move toward a society that none of us will want to live in, including very wealthy people.
Now, a listener asked a question that I know the answer, but it'd be good to get you to express your opinion on this. What's your thought about the federal estate tax?
I'm a supporter of it. I think it's one, you know, it was passed 100 years ago under the encouragement of President Theodore Roosevelt. He was, you know, no longer the president, but he became a champion of this idea of putting some kind of brake on the concentration of wealth and power. And, you know, I think it's had that effect. It's encouraged people to give to philanthropy. It's encouraged people to spread the wealth around and invest it broadly. And it's discouraged wealthy heirs from just becoming completely dependent on inheritances. And it also has raised substantial money for public investments. So, and here we are, 102 years later now, Congress is once again talking about abolishing the estate tax.
Doug on Highland. Hi, Doug. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Thanks. Good morning, Jim. Great topic today.
Thank you.
I wanted to, your guest, you mentioned how rates are much higher during the Eisenhower years, which is a time of great prosperity. They also seem to have more of a sense of common interest. They had just come out of World War II, and that had to be paid off. Up to that point, it was the most expensive war in U.S. history. We're now at a point where we've had two wars that are at least as expensive as World War II, but there just doesn't seem to be this sense of common purpose, even if one wanted to focus on paying off the cost of those wars, which aren't talked about that much.
Thank you, Doug. Chuck, your response?
Yeah, Doug, that's a really important point, that something maybe has shifted in the culture. And if you know, during World War II, we as a country, you know, conscripted wealth, meaning we had progressive taxes during the war to help pay for the war. In the last two wars that we've lived through, we have borrowed to pay for them. We've just added to the national debt. So that's a good comparison, really. But I think your underlying point, Doug, is that we have changed as a culture. There's a little bit less of it. We're in it together, a sense of solidarity and a little bit more we're all on our own and we don't owe anything to anybody.
When you
and
say
I think that will diminish us.
A little bit?
Yeah. We've gone to an extreme individualism.
Okay. 877-217-5757 for Chuck Collins. Ray in Prairieville. Hi, Ray. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Thanks for taking my call, Jim. I just ought to congratulate Mr. Collins on his attitudes and outlooks on this. And the question I'd have is there any chance of reforming our tax system, Stelly system here in Louisiana, and increasing the taxes on the rich, like you said, above $500,000 or whatever, nationally? With the Republican control of both legislatures, I don't see a lot of chance. We need more moderates to look at this. I'll take my answer off the air, Jim.
All right. I doubt that Chuck's familiar with the intricacies of the Stelly plan, but we had a plan in Louisiana, Chuck, that did some of the things that you're advocating at a very minor level, and the citizens at large voted for it, actually approved it, and then the legislature, in its wisdom, overturned what the citizens had approved. Taxes right now, when politicians are talking about them, and this includes members of both parties, they try not to say they're for any tax. When did we get to the point where tax was such a naughty word in the political atmosphere?
Well, probably maybe in the late 70s and 80s, there was really focused organizing work to attack the whole idea of taxes and government as a way to solve our common problems. But what's interesting, Jim, in the last decade is public attitudes are starting to shift. There's widespread support for what Ray is saying, which is we should have a more restore the progressivity of the tax system, that the wealthy should pay their fair share, pay more. And this is where you have a situation like the Stelly Plan, where you have citizens support it. And this is true at the national level. People want the wealthy to pay more taxes. And even many wealthy people are saying, wow, we're swimming in tax breaks. We should be paying more as part of a fair tax system. So right now we have a situation, and we're about to enter into, really starting tomorrow probably, we're going to be hearing about this new federal tax reform, the Better Deal Plan is what it's being called. It's going to be a huge giveaway of more tax breaks for the wealthy. So it's really going the opposite direction of what the wider public wants.
You have focused on something you call philanthropic power among the very rich. The very rich, being the very rich, they are involved in philanthropy, and they do give more than the rest of us. But there is a power to doing that, isn't there?
Yeah, you know, as wealth has concentrated in fewer hands, some of that's going into foundations and charities, which is good, but it represents another form of private power, if you will. So I predict, a decade from now, we're going to have these huge mega foundations that every billionaire will be creating a foundation, and some of that philanthropy will be doing good things, but some of it will be going to very special projects and things that actually perpetuate the interests of a very small group of people. So philanthropy is not a substitute for an adequately funded public sector.
Now, I recall a day, and in fact, I remember the year. It was 2000 when our current president, Donald John Trump, called for a tax on billionaires, a billionaire tax. Now, he's changed his tune, but at one time, he was sounding a lot like you, Chuck.
That's right. No, I think I remember the day, too, because he was talking about a wealth tax. He was advocating for a tax on, and he even says this today sometimes. He says, My fellow Wall Streeters, you know, he supports the idea of closing what's called the carried interest loophole, which is something that hedge fund operators operate. So there's a kind of progressive populist bone there in Donald Trump somewhere, where he just understands that maybe the wealthy should pay more as well.
Here's a question from a listener: do you support reparations?
Well, that's a good question. I definitely think we as a country have to grapple with the long legacy of the legacy of slavery. But even just more recently, looking at after World War II, you and I have been talking about this great, you know, wealth expansion. But we put a generation of white families on the wealth building express train, debt free education. Low interest loans. One of my uncles got a 1% fixed rate 40-year loan from Farmers Home Administration to buy a farm in Ohio. That's a great example of the things we did as a society, and we left people of color out of that. So it's going to be hard to get African Americans and even other people of color to have a level playing field unless we acknowledge that history in some way repair it. And I actually think a tax on wealth that would fund debt-free education and first-time home buyer programs for those who've been excluded would go a long way toward repairing that historic racial wealth divide.
The guest is Chuck Collins. The book is Born on Third Base. Scott asks, can you tell us what percentage of the population pay the federal estate tax and the amount of the exemptions?
Yeah, I mean, today, if you have less than $5.5 million or $11 million for a couple, then the estate tax does not apply to you. So it's only, you know, families with wealth starting at $11 million that pay the tax, which ends up being about 1 out of 1,000 households in the United States. So it's a very, very small percentage. Now, there's going to be a lot of confusion about this. We're going to hear more about farmers losing their farms. We're going to hear about small businesses being stressed out by the estate tax. That is actually not accurate. It's kind of part of the campaign to confuse everybody about who actually pays the estate tax. It's a tax only paid by multimillionaires and billionaires.
And for those unfamiliar with your backstory, it's a good one. You're the great-grandson of a guy named Oscar Mayer.
That's right. Yep. I had a lot of bologna as a young man, and sausage, and it's a great German family immigrant success story, a business that started in Chicago in 1884, and I'm the fourth generation. But it gave me an interesting perspective, which is when in the 80s and 90s, I could sort of see how wealth was multiplying.
Mm-hmm.
The wealth was creating wealth in my family, and yet I was working with people who were struggling just to, you know, as their paycheck right. started to shrink.
We're going
to
slide one call in. We only have a minute to go, so please be brief. Yeah. Patrick in Ennisfold Estates, you're on with Chuck Collins. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, I think 100 years of socialism and communism has proven it doesn't work, but you talk about reparations. Don't you think it's just good to be here in America? Then, you know, if I was a black person, I would be glad to be here in America than to be over there in Africa.
All right, your response, Chuck. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, Patrick. And I would just say, to have a healthy capitalism, we need to be concerned about these inequalities. And I think, to be fair, to understand that, you know, 275 years of slavery and 90 years of Jim Crow and all those things were barriers to wealth creation for people of African heritage, and that to be a mature society, we just have to grapple with how that passed.
We've got to go, but thank you, Chuck Collins. It's been a pleasure.